Time to talk home renovation, reusing building materials, home inspections, all kinds of things relating to the home today. I'm Larry Mueller. My guests today are John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg, been with us a number of times, involved with historic restoration and other water issues, and is also a licensed home inspector. John, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
And welcoming back again, Bob Falk. Bob is from Madison, research engineer at U.S. Forest Products Laboratories, and has done some groundbreaking research on reusing of building materials. And, Bob, pleasure to have you back as well.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
Tell you what, we've seen a real resurgence, I think, in reusing materials. Have we not, Bob?
We really have. I think people are around the country are becoming more and more aware that there are quality building materials that are routinely thrown away when buildings are demolished or when remodeling is done. So there's really been a resurgence of folks that go out and collect these materials and then provide them for sale for reuse for the do-it-yourselfer and for contractors. And we see that here in Madison with the Habitat for Humanity Restore that takes in a lot of materials. They have a deconstruction crew that goes out and salvages materials and provide them at a much lower cost than new for folks that come in and want to do remodeling or building products, projects.
And, John, you do a lot of actually restoration, do you not, bringing back those homes that need to be restored?
I do, Larry, and we are always looking for original parts. We are always visiting architectural salvage yards. We have this group of people who we call when we're looking for things. And one of the things that reuse is so important is so many of the old things are so much higher quality.
Yeah,
you know, we're looking at old growth woods, at old oak floors with beautiful oxidized finish, of things that we have great difficulty getting today.
Well, you know, and it's true even on a place like the University of Wisconsin campus. If you look at the buildings that were built, let's say the 70s and thereabouts, 60s and 70s, those buildings were not built to last like the older buildings. There are some old buildings on campus that they go way back, and they're still in pretty darn good shape, and a lot of our buildings that were built in the 60s aren't, unfortunately.
And a lot of them have more architectural character, and I think, John, dealing with a lot of the historic homes, trying to find parts at times can be really difficult, and the only resource is off of another building. And so it makes sense to try to salvage those materials for historic restoration and enhancing a new home. You can use some of these old architectural elements to provide a focal point in a new home as well.
Tell you what, I haven't given the number yet, so let me do that. If you'd like to join in with your own question or comment as we talk home renovation, reusing these building materials, home inspections, water issues, give us a call, water issues in your home, I should say. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments, and we'd love to get you on the air. Well, moisture has suddenly become a little bit of an issue, John Freiberger. There's been quite a bit of rain through many parts of Wisconsin after a long dry spell. Are you seeing any water damage kinds of things to worry about?
We see a lot more in the summer, Larry, because we get so much wind associated with the water. So you find houses that don't leak when the water is coming straight down, that when we get wind-driven water, things start coming through walls and windows, following the air currents right into the house. So we've had a busy week or two.
Yeah, I would guess so. We had a situation in our house, and it only happened once, where we had some water coming in. We had a driving rain, like as you say, and suddenly we had this little wet patch in our ceiling, and we never could figure out where it went, but it dried up. We checked it was dry up in there, and we could, even getting up into the attic, we couldn't tell how it got in there. And it was one of these horizontal rains that are pretty much horizontal to the ground, and that's where your problems can come.
That's right. If you've got a positive pressure on the exterior of the house on the side that's taking the wind, you're going to actually get negative pressure on the inside. Your house is actually going to suck water right through wall assemblies unless you've got a really good wind and water barrier on the exterior. And that's one thing where we've really been a little remiss in our design standards for modern homes, is we really have not been doing a great job of providing wind and water barriers. Fortunately, in the last two or three years, things have really improved. And we have some great resources out there now for how to do things right. But we are seeing so many homes from the 70s, 80s, and 90s where the houses are rotting. Yeah. One of the other things, to go back to this reclaiming materials again, so much of what we build a house out of now, we call was wood. It was wood until we ground it up. We sort of semi-digested it, and now we use it to build. And these old houses had this wonderful solid woods that did not attract fungal growth. They did not rot easily. They were far superior building products to many of the things that we're seeing today. I mean, oriented strand board. I mean, if you really want to grow mushrooms, OSB is a wonderful place to do it. And so many people have mushrooms in their walls.
Well, comment from you, Bob?
Well, I would say that the fact that we have a lot of these particle-based products, engineered wood products, is a result of the fact that we've cut down all the old-growth timber in this country that provided these wonderful solid wood materials that many of our old homes are built from. So it's really a fact that we just don't have the resource anymore to provide these higher quality materials. I would say that a lot of the engineered wood products, if they're used as designed, they will give long performance. Mm-hmm. But it's key to keep them dry, and a lot of that comes in how you construct the house, as John has said, using wind and moisture barriers and understanding how moisture runs off of buildings and how it's... breeze in and out of a building is very important to get in getting good performance from these products.
Well, we have every line filled, so let's take some calls here.
Okay.
Kate in Fox Cities, your turn. Hi, Kate. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have an older bungalow, 1.5-story home that has original cedar shake on the side, and I've had the home for 4 years. I know it needs to be re-insulated, but I've been holding out till I can sandblast and restain the shake. And I wonder, should I do that, or should I just do what everybody else is doing and cover up the cedar shake with aluminum or vinyl? What do you think?
Well, John Freiberger, what do you think?
Well, cedar shingles are wonderful things. They'll last almost forever depending upon the grade. And the nice thing about a cedar shingle house is, you can restore one side at a time, and it isn't horribly expensive. You also find if you put a good coating on the cedar, a hand-dip pre-finished coating, that you get paints where you don't have to touch them for 20 years. I think somebody's even offering a 30-year warranty on them. So if you're going to insulate your house, you may want to do it with stages and restore your exterior in stages. You're going to have to take off some cedar shingles so that you can drill through the sheathing beneath to access the wall cavities to fill the insulation. And then you can put on, wherever you've got badly twisted or cracked shingles, you can put on new ones. Make sure that you go to the, Bob, correct me if I'm going to get this wrong, the Cedar Shingle Bureau. Is it Cedar Shingle and Shake Bureau? Is that correct, Bob?
I think it's, Red Cedar Shake and Shingle Bureau, something
right.
like that. I think if you search on the internet under Cedar Shakes or Cedar Shingles, you'll find them.
You can download all kinds of standards and how to install things, and then really look at the quality of the shingles. You really want your house, since it's an old bungalow, probably has all vertical grain shingles on it.
Right, that's correct.
And if you just buy blue label shingles now, you have to throw out 25% of them because they've got face grain in them. Mm. There are two firms, Meeker and Anbrook, that make all face grain old-fashioned shingles, and I think it's worth ordering from them.
Okay.
And one other thing to think about, Kate, since we were talking about moisture earlier, is that you have to be sure that you've got a vapor barrier on the interior of your house if you're going to insulate the outside walls, or you're going to have condensation problems. So take a look at maybe vapor barriering the inside of your house with a liquid applied vapor barrier, which is just a specified and approved acrylic latex paint.
Well, that actually leads me to another question, if you don't mind, because I have all the original plaster walls inside,
mm-hmm.
And they're in pretty good shape. would you recommend me taking that down and doing drywall with a vapor barrier then? Or
no, all you need to do is put one more coat of paint on that wall, and if you've got a good engineer, they can actually test the permeability of your existing paint. Depending upon the type of paint, it may be so impermeable at this point that you already have a vapor barrier in your house.
Okay.
But it's something you need to know because you don't want to get condensation in the wall. You're going to move where the dew point occurs, and you're going to stop a lot of air movement and drying inside that wall. So we have to make sure that it stays drier than it is right now.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Kate. Appreciate it. And let's go to Katie in Mount Horeb. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I think my question's a lot like the previous one. I have a farmhouse that was built around 1880, and unless there's another John Freiberger inspector, I think, John, maybe you did our inspection when we bought in 2002. We need to paint the house. We had it painted when we first moved here by sort of a low-budget guy, quick and dirty, just to make it look a little bit better for the short term. But now I want to paint it and do it really well. And we've got places where there are loads of layers of paint on the outside, and we've got places where it's peeling, even from the paint job that was done a couple years ago. And I don't even know where to begin, what the best way is to prepare that surface, what kind of paint to use.
What did you say? I'm sorry. Did you tell us what the kind of siding you had?
Well, it's a wood.
A wood siding.
A wood siding. If I'm not mistaken, John, I think you told me it was cedar when you inspected, but I could be wrong there. It's just clapboard. You know, it's the original clapboard from 1880.
Yeah. Well, Bob, a comment from you first?
Well, I would sort of refer to the last caller's comment about sandblasting. I wouldn't do that on any wood siding. I think it depends on how much of the old paint you want to get off. You can mechanically remove paint by using some of these sanders, or there are infrared devices that will take off the old paint. If you want to go right back to the original surface, then you'll want to either sand that and then put a good primer and a couple of top coats of latex to get a good finish again. But it depends on how far you want to go. You might want to just patch certain areas that are peeling and do that in a localized fashion. But to get that original flat look, if you've got different layers of paint, may require going back and redoing the whole surface.
Yeah, John, do you agree with that?
No, I agree. I guess the other thing that you need to check on, Katie, is you're going to need to test for lead because that can affect how you do it. And this is why Bob was saying don't sandblast. The last thing we need is a lead-covered yard, either up in the Fox Cities or in Mount Horeb. So you can actually go to the hardware store and get some little oxidizer kits, and you can do a little testing. You just put some chemical on. If it turns bright red, you've got a lot of lead. If it turns pink, you got some lead. But do that first. It's sort of cost-benefit analysis. I think Bob and I both agree that these old cedar houses had some wonderful siding. And again, it was old-growth wood. A lot of it was vertical grain. And some of that siding will literally last 200 years if you take care of it. There's also company, I believe, in Racine called American Restoration Products that makes specialized paints for old houses. So I guess you're going to have to, as Bob said, decide whether you want to just sort of keep up and maintain it or whether you really want to go full bore, strip it, and then put on these new breathing, non-layering paints so that it never peels on you again.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's what I want to do. We're going to be here forever, and I'd like to have it look as much as it did. And I'm pretty sure, 99% sure, there's a fair amount of lead in some of those layers. So what does that tell me about how I should remove it if I already know that?
Well, you're probably going to be looking at either low-temperature heat stripping, which is pretty onerous, or a chemical removal. And you can check on some of the chemicals. The price of chemical removing has dropped. They have some that go on almost as paste. There are firms in the Madison area. They'll come out and basically spray your house with a film of stripper, put black plastic over it, so it looks like you've wrapped it in a giant garbage bag. And 3 days later, they'll come back and roll it all up and take the paint off. It isn't cheap, but the siding you've got on that house is worth a small fortune, too. So it becomes a matter of cost-benefit analysis. You've got some real good quality there, but you may have to spend some money to really maintain that quality and to reduce your maintenance costs.
And to find a firm in the Madison area that does that kind of stripping, should I just like Google paint stripping or something?
Yeah, paint stripping lead certified. And they are going to be able to give you educational certificates. They'll be able to give you state certificates that they're certified for lead work. There are several very good firms in the Madison area. Some of them do multiple things. Like one I'm thinking of actually does duct cleaning, mold cleanup, and lead work. You know, they do all kinds of environmental things. So there are several firms out there, and just like the cost of asbestos removal has declined by about 80% in the last 20 years, the cost of lead removal is declining too, maybe not as rapidly, but something to look into because you've got good quality there, and I'd hate to see vinyl siding going over it or something like that.
Oh, heavens no.
Okay.
Thank you.
I would also add that when you're dealing with cedar or redwood, you can get what's called extractive bleed. These are two species that the extractives or some of the chemicals in the wood can actually bleed through the paint finish. And so it's important to put the proper primer down on cedar and redwood. And what our finishing chemists would recommend is a solvent-based or oil-based alkyd primer that are stain blocking, and that'll prevent some of this extractive bleed that comes through from the wood.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg, one of our guests, the other Bob Falk of the U.S. Forest Products Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking home renovation, repair, reuse of building materials, home inspections today with our two guests, John Freiberger and Bob Falk. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234, in Madison at 263-1890. Don in Pittsville, you are next. Hi, Don.
Yeah, I've been checking into, I found out that you can get up to a $500 tax credit from the federal government if you put a steel roof on your house. And there's something about it has to be certified. I don't know by whom or what. And I was wondering if you put a steel roof of the material, you know, the type that you put on like a pole building, would that qualify?
You know,
I've
I
never
don't...
heard of such a tax credit.
Steel roof tax credit.
Nope, I haven't heard of that either.
Well, we've checked on the Internet, and it is available under certain conditions. And you can get that up until the end of this year.
Who is it available from, Don?
The federal government will allow that on your tax credit on your income tax.
John, would that be part of a like a historic tax credit for an original metal roof on a house? Or?
I don't think so, because you have to be on the state or eligible for the state register or the national register to get that tax credit. I think Don, you've got us stumped here,
mm-hmm.
And probably the thing to do is to make a phone call to your local congressman's office. And see, this is the sort of thing congressmen do for you all the time, is they'll look it up and get the information for you, because Bob and I are stumped.
And it's your congressperson will get back to you. They usually, the rule is for most of them, 5 days and no more to get back to someone who's voting for or against you. So, and I know that tax credit, I just went online to look at it. There is a tax credit. It runs through the end of this year, December 31st of 2007, energy tax credits for metal roofing purchases. So it's something you'd want to, and I'll have to read up a little more on this because I didn't know a thing about it either. So that's probably good advice there. And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Lynn in Evansville next. Lynn, hello to you.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I'm very interested again in the sites that you've noted for recycled wood products, but my more immediate problem, which I hope is on topic, has to do with moisture. I have a 1950s small ranch house, and the concrete driveway abuts the house's foundation, and where the driveway and foundation abut is a crevasse. And that is a source of leaking into my basement. So I'm wondering, number one, if there's a particular filler sealant that I could use in that crack area, and also if there is something that I can use on the interior surface of that basement wall to prevent it from leaking into my basement.
Lynn, how wide is that seam?
Oh, 1.5 inches, I would say, primarily. 1.5 inches.
Oh, ouch. Were it narrower, it would be a whole lot easier. Wide cracks are really difficult to deal with.
Uh-huh.
Most of the self-leveling urethanes and the other things that work well up to half inch are just not going to perform very well when we get to that width. There are some products online which are gasketing materials that we use mostly for where masonry buildings meet sidewalks. Unfortunately, I can't remember any of the websites.
Okay.
But there are actual gasketing materials that you can install in a crack that wide.
Okay.
The other thing that you could try is to make that crack more or less impermeable. One way of doing that would be to get lime screenings or lime fines. And this is like, it's very, very fine gravel. It's just crushed limestone. And you can put that in there, and if you can tamp that down, that will become about as impermeable as concrete. Now, the other thing that's probably going on, you've probably got a bunch of hollows underneath there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this might help fill in the hollows as well.
Okay.
And why don't you give that a try first? That's very low cost. You know, you get a, you know, if you've got a pickup truck and get a few bushels of it and, you know, put it in there with a trowel and then tamp it down with a hammer and a flat chisel or flat piece of metal.
Okay.
And then see what that does. If that'll stop the water from going under there, that should help a great deal because there's nothing you can really apply to the interior of the basement that is going to stop water on the downward side of the water pressure unless there's something brand new. Bob, do you know of anything that's working on the inside of a basement wall?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Just to go back for a minute to the metal roofs, there are some Energy Star labeled metal roof systems that have at least 65% solar reflectance for low sloping and 25% solar reflectance for steep sloping roofing. And, of course, that can save on cooling costs in the summertime. And there is a $500 tax credit, which is really $500 in your pocket because you subtract it directly from your tax liability. So, and I'm not so sure. I wonder if it's more for south or warmer climates, but I think it'll apply anywhere. So probably worth looking at Energy Star roofing, and that'd be another place to go. To our Energy Star website and take a look at get some more information from there. Maurice in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Maurice.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
I've got a house that was built in the late 60s, and it has Repson cedar vertical siding on it, and I'm starting to get some buildup of a black surface, looks like mold of some sort, on the outside. I've used Jomac on it in the past, but I can't get it off. And then I had experience yesterday when I was doing my windows where I used a hose on one of the windows and water showed up in the house, as well as in the jacuzzi room, tripped one of the electrical down in the basement switches in the jacuzzi room, which is subject to, it has installed electrical so that it'll do that. So obviously I'm getting some water into the house, and if I use my power washer to try to get some of that off, I think I'll have a real problem. How am I going to get that black stuff off of my house? I have stain on it. It's a cedar stain, which is oil based.
Okay, I think you probably have some mildew on your siding, and I would suggest trying a bleach solution. We have suggested in the past at the Forest Products Lab about a 30% household bleach and water, but I would start out weaker than that, maybe a cup of bleach to a gallon of water. Either spray it on with a one of the hand pump sprayers or a mister or a sponge mop or something that might work, and see if that starts to remove the mold. It should remove it pretty quick.
Are you familiar with Jomax?
I am not familiar with that. There are some
add bleach to that product, and in the past, it's gotten to the point where on the older part, which is on the front of the house, dates back to the '60s. The sides and the back of the house date back about 16 years ago. on the older part, it's really gotten to the point where that mildew doesn't seem to want to come off.
Well, that could be some of this extractive bleed that I have referred to on the earlier call. And I'd have to look into that to find out how you might remove that. But typically, the mildew is the first thing to try to tackle. As far as leaking into the house, what kind of joints are on these vertically applied panels? Is it board and batten where you have a vertical covering piece over each joint, or is it tongue and groove? Or
it's board and batten.
Well, I don't know if John can speak to this, that there might you might not.
John, you want to throw in your two cents worth?
The leaking seemed to be around the windows, which were installed 16 years ago, thermopane windows.
Okay.
That seemed to be where the leaking occurred.
Right. Now, there's probably a joint that wasn't taken care of terribly well 16 years ago, since we weren't quite as sensitive back then to things like energy loss. Probably to start with, Maurice, is just sort of look for caulk joints that may be open. I don't think we want to look at taking out windows and reinstalling them correctly. So probably the thing to try to do is just to put a barrier on the outside at this point and caulk very carefully.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jean in Juneau, you are next. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I understand the cedar siding is very long-lasting. What about the old cedar roofs? I don't know if it's cedar shakes or what they're called. Are they very long-lasting also? And this house is about 100 years old with the original roof. Is that possible that roof is still okay? And are the boards underneath that were put on in 100 years ago better than, well, I know it wouldn't be plywood. Could it be possible this roof does not leak?
It is possible. Cedar will last an incredibly long time if it dries quickly. And a cedar roof needs to dry from both sides. So, Gene, if you look up in your attic, you'll probably see what we call skip sheathing. So you'll see a board and airspace, a board and airspace.
Okay.
The more airspace you have, if you get close to 50% airspace, that is ideal, and that's what we do today. In the old days, when your house was built, the sheathing, you may have everything from 1x16s to 1x3s up there. And in those cases, there often wasn't quite enough airspace. But good quality red cedar can have a tremendously long life if there's no overhanging trees, if the attic is well vented, and if it's put on skip sheathing, and if it was old fashioned vertical grain.
Then why aren't they used more now?
The material isn't available. It's we just don't have those old growth cedar trees that make good shingles and shake, and they have to be relatively large in diameter, old growth to give you that performance. The other thing I'd mention is that, of course, roofs are receive more damage, more ultraviolet, more direct rain than the siding on a house would. So generally, I think you would expect more life out of siding, plus it's painted. A roof is typically not painted. As John said, it's very important to keep off collected debris. If the house is underneath a tree, can provide more moisture. And the other thing on wood roofs is you want to use copper flashing and or zinc sacrificial metal pieces that go up at the peak of the roof that will wash the roof in copper ion or zinc ion, which will keep down the mildew and mold growth, and that'll significantly lengthen the life of a roof of cedar. And they can fail in 5 years, a cedar roof, if the conditions are wrong, or they can last, as you've mentioned, 100 years.
Okay, this is not our home. This is a home we're looking at and to buy. And the elderly lady said there are no leaks. We have not been up in the attic. The shingles don't look that great from down below. It's a tall house, so we haven't gotten up to see the roof. But they don't look that great from down below, so would we assume that the entire roof is like that?
Well, we don't make any assumptions. We hire a Wisconsin certified home inspector to do this for you.
Okay,
and you also, when you call the home inspectors, you ask them what they know about cedar roofs. And then, again, you can go to the Cedar Shake and Shingle Bureau that we mentioned earlier, so you can learn a bit about cedar roofs. If you want a lot of information on cedar roofs, you can also email me, and I'll send you the specifications for how to do a correctly installed cedar roof if you replace it.
Okay.
And if this house is 100 years old and has some historic value, take a look at possibly getting it on the state register, in which case you can get a 25% tax credit for the replacement of that roof. You can do that by going to the State Historical Society of Wisconsin website and look at historic tax credits.
Okay, thanks much.
Thanks very much for calling. What's your email address, by the way, John?
It is FREI at chorus.net. And chorus is spelled like a singing group, C-H-O-R-U-S.
Okay.
John, wouldn't you agree that if just looking at the roof, if there was a lot of cupped shingles, that that might be a red flag that the roof is not performing very well?
That's correct. And if it simply looks very weathered and if the lower edges are looking bad, generally what we find when we inspect roofs is it's more important to look at the bottom half of the shingle than the top half. So they have a tendency to decay from the bottom because they dry more poorly at the bottom. So the inspector can put a ladder up to the roof and can actually feel. And if the underside of the shingle, which is maybe it was a half inch thick, if a quarter of that is sort of punky and gone, then we're really getting near the end. But you're certainly right on the cupping. And this is the problem we see on all these new roofs where 25% of the shingles they're putting up should never be on the roof in the first place.
Oh. Thank you very much, Gene, for calling. Appreciate it. And John in Door County, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon. Good morning, I guess. I have probably a relatively simple question, but we built a house 9 years ago, and we were on the water on Green Bay, and we have a northern exposure, and what we had was we used cedar exterior siding, and then the entire interior is knotty pine car siding, and we have experienced when we get a hard wind off the water in the winter time, it's very hard to keep the house warm because we get a lot of air blowing through. And when we talked to our builder about it, he said, well, it's because you have wood that's shrunk on the exterior and wood that's shrunk now on the interior. And when we originally built the house, my wife really wanted to have that all those walls foamed, and for some reason we were talked out of it. And I guess the question I have now is what's the best way to try and insulate that? Is it from the inside out or from the outside in, or do you have any other suggestions?
John, what do you think?
Definitely from the outside in. It sounds like you do not have a wind and a wind barrier on the house that's adequate.
Yeah, and they put a barrier in at the time, but I am quite sure they didn't do a good. It wasn't a good. We also heard you should have an extra thick one, and there was holes kind of punched in it here and there,
right.
And I just don't think it was done very well.
It was probably done poorly. What I'm going to suggest is you take a look at the website of the Energy and Environmental Building Association, which is real short. It's
EECA. Okay.
Edward Bob Apple.
Edward Bob Apple.
.org.
.org. Okay.
You can take a look at their water management guide, which is written by my buddy Joe Stilbrick. And that has wonderful detailings on how to apply wind and water barriers. Now, because a wind barrier and a water barrier are really the same thing.
Okay.
The shrinking of the wood on the interior and the shrink of the siding should have absolutely nothing to do with the amount of air moving through that wall. It's a failure to put on a good barrier. The foam would have been a great idea because the foam is a high-efficiency insulation. It's a vapor barrier and it's a wind barrier. But since you don't have that, you probably have plenty of insulation. You just have too much air moving through that insulation.
Sure. And then I guess on that same note, I should add, we have a exposed rafter ceiling where when you look up, you see the rafters, and then on top of that is knotty pine tongue and groove, and then above that is, they used to call it thermocal, the hard foam insulation in squares.
Right.
Is there a way to, we think we're losing heat up through that as well, because now you see some shrinkage in the, between the boards, and is there a clear kind of caulk or sealer or something like that that could be used there, or?
Well, what they should have done is they should have put up the rafters, and the knotty pine, which is probably a structural tongue and groove inch and a half thick, would have gone on top of that.
Right.
Then there should have been a full vapor barrier up there, a like a 6 mil layer of visqueen. And then the insulation should have been on top of that. So that visqueen would have been both your air barrier and your vapor barrier. Now, you maybe need to just look in the cracks and see if you see plastic. If you do, you shouldn't have a lot of air loss through there. Now, the other thing is you need to make sure that you actually got R38 in the foam insulation. And, Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's going to be over 6 inches of isosanurate foam, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, so you need at least, if you've only got 4 inches thick up there, you maybe are having too much radiant loss.
Okay. And that wouldn't surprise me either. So, okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call. All right. Bob in Wauwatosa, you're next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
Busy day today.
Yeah.
Say, I have two questions. The first involves whether your experts have ever heard of applying a 50-50 mix of boiled linseed oil and turpentine as a first application for partially exposed old exterior wood before priming the wood? That's my first question.
Well, I think that that's sort of the basis of what was called the original Forest Products Lab wood finish. I think one of the problems with that is just linseed oil is difficult to polymerize if it's not boiled or further chemically treated. So I'd be a little concerned about just taking linseed oil with turpentine and putting it on something because it may take a long, long time to dry.
Even if it's boiled linseed oil?
Well, it's less of a problem if it's boiled, but it still can serve as food for mildew growth as well. And so using, especially on the exterior, if it's going to get wet.
Is there something better, a better way to do this?
Well, I would think a more of a commercially available product may be better than a home mixed recipe.
Yeah. John, what do you think?
Well, we used to do this all the time, especially on really old wood, because it helped fill the grain a little bit. But Bob's certainly right. The linseed oil can certainly make things turn black a little bit, and I think you really have to look for the word polymerized in it. There are some people out there that are now redoing old finishes in modern ways. Sutherland Wells would be one of the companies. I know that they have a website. Bob, I'm wondering, does polymerized tung oil have the same mildew breeding capacity as does the linseed oil? Because I know polymerized exterior tung oil is available from Sutherland Wells, and we've used it just straight on decking and things.
Well, our chemists tell me that some of these linseed oils and more natural-based oils, one of the reasons paints and finishes manufacturers are going to synthetics is because you don't have the mildew and mold problem because there's no food source now. It's just, you know, plastic-based, chemically-based polymers. And these organic compounds, linseed oil, they're derived from plants, and so they're food for some of these organisms. And you know, the boiling and other chemical treatments can certainly reduce that. But I would think that in with the exception of historic properties and going that way, there are probably better finishes.
So if I could find polymerized linseed oil, that might work with the turpentine, that would be all right?
Well, I think that I guess I can't say for sure it's going to be a great alternative. Certainly it'd be better than raw linseed oil, boiled or further treated. I think they call it more of an alkyd chemical treatment on that linseed oil will further polymerize it, and it'll dry faster, and it will be less susceptible. So,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Question number two is about keeping weeds down between patio blocks. Two specific questions is putting down two layers of landscaping cloth on top of the gravel fines. I guess first you're supposed to put down coarse gravel and then either sand or limestone fines. Is two layers of landscape cloth a good idea rather than one? And the second point is rather than sweeping just straight sand between the patio blocks when you have them all down, is it weed efficient, shall we say, to sweep in a mix of sand and cement. I think this is called a patio mix. And any other suggestions you might have?
Well, that's a good question, which may stump both of our people today. I wish I had all the answers to that. The one thing I do know, and we're putting a patio in our home, the one thing I do know is that most of the work in putting the patio is not laying those bricks down, but it's the work that gets done ahead of time, which is digging out the soil and laying down the proper layers so that you don't have the weed problem between the blocks.
Right.
I would add that in my experience in using weed barrier in my own garden with mulch, that you can certainly get weeds growing on top of a weed barrier,
yeah,
as that mulch breaks down. So even if you have a couple layers, if you have some soil on top of that weed barrier, the weeds will grow in it.
There's no doubt about that. I can tell you that with all certainty, having laid some of that down myself in a certain area along the side of our house where I just didn't want to get anything growing. And a couple of years later, it's growing on top of the weed barrier, and now I have to pull that weed barrier out, and it's a real mess. Real mess. Thanks very much for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg, our guest today, as is Bob Falk of Madison, research engineer at the U.S. Forest Products Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
At Wisconsin Public Radio, we're grateful for the ongoing support from our sustaining members. You give faithfully every month using automatic transfers from your checking account, credit, or debit card. This provides an ongoing source of funding for WPR programs. Visit WPR.org to become a sustaining member.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Sauk County Art Association Summer Art Classic, celebrating 43 years of art in Baraboo, featuring artists and craftsmen, food, entertainment, and children's activities, Saturday, August 11th from 9 to 4 in downtown Baraboo.
Talking home renovation, repair, reusing materials, home inspections with our two guests today, John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg and Bob Falk of the U.S. Forest Products Laboratory. We'll go back to the phones. Jill in Stoughton, it's your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I am planning to rip up some carpeting in an office space that's about 200 square feet, and I want to put down wood flooring or simulated wood flooring. And I want your thoughts on laminate versus wood in terms of durability, ease of installation, and cost.
Okay. We'll start with Bob Falk here.
Well, there's certainly a lot of engineered wood, what they call engineered wood flooring, out there that can perform quite well. You cannot refinish it. One of the advantages of a solid wood floor is that you can come back periodically if it wears and refinish that floor.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big issues, of course, with wood floors is to make sure that you install them and the wood is dry and so it doesn't shrink and you get a good finish on it. And I think either are very good alternatives. Probably the wood flooring is, solid wood flooring is definitely going to cost you more than,
okay,
than
is
the engineered
floor. Is there a significant
floor
difference between the for a space that size, 200 square feet?
Well, I think, I don't know if John is current with some of the costs of wood flooring. I think solid wood flooring, just the cost of the wood is going to be $3 to $5 for oak flooring per square foot, depending on the quality of the oak. And there's other, Brazilian cherry seems to be very popular these days, solid wood flooring.
Okay.
And I'm not sure about the engineered wood flooring. I think that's something you can go look at your box store or through your contractor.
Okay. And in terms of installation, because this is something I'm planning to do myself, do one of them install easier than the other?
Oh, there's no question that the engineered wood flooring, it's pre-finished. I think it's a lot more a lot easier for the do-it-yourselfer to put that in.
Okay.
And I would recommend that probably if you're going to do it yourself.
Okay. And when you say engineered wood, is that synonymous with laminate, or is that
yes, that's Exactly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Ron in Edgerton, your turn now. Hi, Ron.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I have two quick questions. First of all, we bought this house in Edgerton, and it's a limestone Cape Cod from the 1920s, an Art Deco-style house. Fossils in the wall. It's really beautiful. But like all the little Cape Cods from that area, tiny, tiny kitchen and bathroom. And so we added 1,000 square feet. The stone now shows on the inside of the addition, all lit up with fish lights. There was a little back porch in knotty pine. We saved all that wood, and that's a recessed medallion in the ceiling that lights up with rope lights. And the woodwork was all made out of the same old wood. Is there, and even the kitchen cupboards, appropriately are from an old tobacco shed from the Edgerton area. But is there any chance of something like that being on the historical register and getting some help with this whole thing tax-wise or anything?
John Freiberger, what do you think?
Probably not, because the original house has been changed so much. There's three ways of getting on the register. One is you're a contributing member of a historic district. So if there would be a historic district in Edgerton that your house was located in, that's certainly the easiest. The secondly, it would have to be somebody famous who would live there. Third, it has to be of such architectural significance that it's worth preserving, that people would actually want to come and study it. The house sounds as if it's unique and has some really interesting character to it, but that is different than the State Historical Society and the Department of Interior's definition for historic, I would think. But you can always go to the State Historic Society website and see what they have.
My second question is the Three Season porch we're doing in the old tobacco shed wood, too. I know you need a vapor barrier in the ceiling before you put the insulation. Do you need one in the walls, too, on the walls for the plastic to go up, the insulation and the plastic, then the knotty or the old barn wood?
Yes, you need a vapor barrier on all surfaces where you are going to have a significant thermal gradient.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. We've got some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast here at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. And email us at talk@wpr.org. Leanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Leanne.
Hi. I had a quick question about home energy efficiency evaluations. We have a 1955 ranch home here in Madison, and we're replacing the windows and doing some other work to increase the efficiency. But I know that there are people who can go around and check the thermal efficiency of the whole house, and I was wondering how we'd find out some information on that.
Okay. John, do you want to start there?
Well, I guess the Yellow Pages are a good place to start. There are people who can come and blower door test your house to see whether you have a lot of air intrusion, infiltration, exfiltration. People will come with infrared cameras and get a good idea where your insulation may be lacking. So there are lots and lots of resources out there.
There's a website, too. And it's suddenly gone by my the energy. I don't think it's the Energy Star website. There's another website. Somebody will call in and let me know. Anyway, you can actually get a credit for having your house done. They will part of the cost, and I know I had it done. Part of the cost it will be covered actually for you in the Madison area. And there are several contractors listed. We'll get that website for you, and the website also contains the names of people who actually do this work and who are certified to do the work.
Great.
So hang on, and we'll get that before the right after the news. We'll be able to give you that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling, Bill in Fitchburg. Your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How are you today?
Great.
Say, I've got my house is it's all made out of concrete. It was built a long time ago, and it's actually like probably one of the first spancrete houses that were made. And what my question is they back then they didn't of course have the in floor heat, and it looks like it's got about 2 inches of concrete poured on top of the actual spancrete. I was wondering what kind of a job or what would be the easiest way to break that stuff up to and then put down the in-floor heat?
Easy. Well, that.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
There is no easy way, Bill. Well, you're going to have to. It's probably gypcrete. It's probably a lightweight concrete topping. I would think, especially if it's only about 2 inches thick. And the best thing to do is to pick a little area and test it, and see if it's really tightly bonded to the spancrete. It is going to be a heck of a job, but sometimes you'll find gypcrete with a lot of air and very lightweight, and it'll come off. So you're really going to have to test it. And even if I drove over and looked at it, I don't think I'd be able to tell you anything but a few taps with a hammer and a chisel to see how easy if it just sort of delaminates from the spancrete and comes up, that it might not be a bad project.
How clean would I mean, how far down to the spancrete would I mean, does it need to be really flat, smooth, or just broken up so then they could lay their coils down and then, you know, gypcrete back over top?
It doesn't have to be terribly clean. You're looking at a hydronic system, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Yeah, so just so that they can get the pipes in, then they will have to tell you, you know, you may lose a little bit of height. They may have to pour more than 2 inches back. But you can. I would talk to your do your test, then talk to your contractor.
Sounds real good. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. John Freiberger and Bob Falk, our guests here as we talk home renovation and repair. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking home renovation, repair, energy saving issues, home inspections, reusing building materials, all kinds of things today with our two guests, John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg. He's involved with historic restoration, water issues. He's a licensed home inspector. Bob Falk of Madison is a research engineer at the U.S. Forest Products Lab. And has done a lot of research on reusing building materials. He co-authored Unbuilding, Salvaging the Architectural Treasures of Unwanted Houses. So we're really happy to have them with us today. I know we'll be talking about basement insulation. We'll be talking about wood flooring over linoleum. We'll be talking about a wood floor that's warping. What about you? If you have a question, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. We'll be right back after this look at the news. Stay with us. We're talking home renovation, reuse of building materials, home inspection issues with John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg. And Bob Falk of the U.S. Forest Products Laboratory in Madison. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question about your own home at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. I mentioned we had a question about wood flooring over linoleum, and Barb in Milwaukee, I think, has that one. Barb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
Yes, when that lady called in saying she was going to do the wood flooring herself, I thought, you know, that's what I want to do. But I had linoleum, and then I put down these self-sticking tiles, and I'd like to put wood flooring in the this is in a kitchen. And someone said, no, I have to take everything up and get down to the subfloor. Is that true, or?
Well, I've never put down this engineered flooring, laminate flooring myself. I believe it's stapled down, John?
It's usually stapled down, though. There's some that are actually floating where you only secure the edges, and it fits together. Basically, you have an interlocking system.
I would be concerned about making sure that it sticks properly to the floor with that linoleum. You said this was newer linoleum.
No, it's pretty old.
Well, you want to be sure it's not 9x9, the old linoleum that might have asbestos in it, which could be a concern. I wouldn't think that solid wood flooring, it would be a problem putting it over linoleum, assuming everything's flat. In fact, old wood flooring, they used to put 15 or 30 pound roofing asphalt paper down before they put down the flooring itself. So linoleum's not a whole lot different. So I think if everything's flat and you get good nailing, that wouldn't be a problem. But the engineered flooring, I don't know, John. What do you think?
Well, probably the thing to do is to visit a store and look at the various installation techniques that the various manufacturers have, and you may find one that will work pretty well.
Okay. And then what do you think of bamboo?
Well, Larry, I just put some new bamboo flooring in, actually, and having it put in an addition in our house. It looks beautiful. And in terms of putting it in yourself, I don't know, because I'm having somebody else do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't know about putting it in, but certainly it's got the hardness and the performance that is equivalent to oak flooring. So I think as far as wearability and durability, it should be work just great.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. It sure looks nice. I'll tell you that. Mary in Rock Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a wood floor. It's mostly maple, tongue and groove, real wood. And it was installed quite a while ago, but we have some warpage. We had used a Watco floor finish on it, and it didn't hold up as well as I'd hoped, and some moisture, you know, but it's mostly near the door. It kind of has, each board is a little bit warped, and some space in between the boards. And I'm ready to refinish and wondering what the best procedure is, thinking about do we need to resand it, and what about the cracks in between? Are they going to be a problem later on?
It sounds like if there's cracks in between, it's probably going a little bit concave or cupping on you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, that means you got water underneath the floor. So,
oh.
Yes, because what happened is the bottom of the piece of wood is now wider than the top of the piece of wood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it got wet on the bottom, and the moisture worked in. Of course, it wasn't finished on the bottom, so
mm-hmm.
it was easier for the water to move in there and swell. And then once it swelled, even when it dried, it kept that unfortunate shape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you're probably going to have to sand it, and you might have to use a material like a higher build polyurethane that will fill those seams,
okay,
so that you don't get more water in there. Now, it's still going to crack. You're not going to. Wood floors always move around, so you'll
mm-hmm.
get some fine cracks. But you don't want you don't want the size of cracks that you can, you know, put a knife blade into, because when you open the door and somebody comes in the winter with snow on their boots, it's going to go right underneath and it's going to warp again.
Yeah.
So try to figure out how the moisture got there, prevent that from happening again, sand it, and use a good finish with a little bit of filler in it.
A little bit of filler in the finish?
Yes. So you may, just the area that warped, you may have to put an extra
mm-hmm.
couple of coats on there to fill that up. And there
okay.
are some waterborne finishes that do a great job. The floor in my kitchen is 100 and something years old, and it's incredibly worn. In fact, I know exactly where Mrs. Brown spent most of her time, and I know where the cook stove was, because the floor is literally an eighth of an inch lower there.
Wow.
But with one of the water polys, I was able to build that up, and where the old joints opened up, these new water polys are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So much better than the old oil-based urethanes, because you can recoat, you can multiple coat, you don't have to sand in between coats.
Oh.
So when you refinish this floor, investigate these new water polys. Is there information on these water poly and floor finishes from the Forest Product Lab, Bob?
I don't think so on floor finishes.
On floor finishes, okay.
All right.
It's a water-based poly, and I can pick that up at a big box store, and it's ready to use for flooring. And
I would call a floor finisher and talk to them. You know, I don't trust big boxes.
I was just thinking the pre-made. I mean, I've seen some products that were made for flooring and water-based polyurethanes,
mm-hmm.
and I just didn't know if that was recommended or.
I would check with a floor finisher, because I'm assuming you're going to have somebody come in and sand this. You really don't want to be sanding the floor yourself. And
oh.
I would start with a professional floor finisher who has a good reputation.
Okay. Yeah, we had done it ourselves to begin with.
Yeah, some professional formulations are much superior to what you buy at the big box, because the big box has got to be cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So the one in the big box might have a whole lot more water in it, in the water-based
oh.
finish, than it has finish.
Okay.
So talk to a professional so that you get something that's really good, and then get an extra gallon or two, and you can refinish the traffic areas yourself over the years very easily.
Okay.
I end up refinishing my kitchen myself about every other year, and it just you know, it takes me a couple of hours. But
oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. I wanted to respond to an earlier caller who wanted to have sort of an energy audit done on her home. And if she goes to the Focus on Energy program. Go online to focusonenergy.com. She will find information there on how to get somebody who's certified to do that. And I know, Bob, you had something. We had a caller who was asking about linseed oil as well, and you had a comment on that.
Yes. Over the break, I was looking up on our website. By the way, for more information on wood finishes and wood use, you can go onto the Forest Products Lab website, which is www.fpl.fs.fed.us. It's kind of complicated, but it's fpl.fs.fed.us. And there is a paints and finishes link there, and there is a PDF on what is called the old Forest Products Lab semi-transparent finish that was developed in 1950, and it used linseed oil, and there's a whole article about that formulation and alternatives to that formulation that might help that caller.
Carol in Elm Grove, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Am I breaking up?
Oh, no, you're okay.
Okay, fine. A couple questions. The first one deals with insulation, and this is a new basement construction in an existing home. And there are a couple things. It was suggested to use friction-fit plastic caps to isolate on the heating ducts the nut and the bolt where that turns the damper so you can get at them. And my second question...
Oh, you broke up right at the critical stage there.
Oh, dear. Where you could get them, where you could buy friction-fit plastic caps. You know what that is?
Yeah, okay. They're just little plugs that you can put into the ceiling, but you do want to make sure you can reach the dampers on your system, because if you need to balance your HVAC system, it's critical to be able to reach that little wing nut and the little lever that controls the damper inside the duct.
Can you do that using a friction-fit plastic cup, or should you use a panel?
The problem is the little lever itself is about 3 inches long, so I really think you're going to need to buy one of the little CPVC access panels, and they have a little frame around them, because otherwise you're really going to have trouble getting your hand up there and actually doing anything with that little control damper.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. And then I was reading about acoustical insulation, and we have to insulate the outside walls. So is acoustical insulation in the ceiling, if we wanted to deaden the sound in the basement, we don't care about the first floor sound, is it effective? There seems to be so many conflicting opinions about the effectiveness of that insulation in the ceiling.
Yeah. Well, when we do design work, we do two things. First, we do put some acoustical insulation in the ceiling, and that can be in sort of a rubber mat form, or it can be in a fiber wool form. But the thing that is probably more important is to get the lower... the longer wavelength, the lower sounds, the clomping sounds, to stop coming through the framing of the house. Because if somebody is walking around in your living room, you're going to hear it below, because it's going to be transferred right through the framing members. So when you put your ceiling in the basement, if you're using a drywall ceiling, use what's called hat channel. So it is an acoustical channel that decouples the framing of the house from the drywall or the other ceiling that you're putting in the basement. So you really need to do both of those things.
Insulation and a half channel?
And hanging your drywall or your wood or your whatever ceiling from hat channel. Or maybe you're just putting in a hanging acoustical ceiling.
No,
you're going to use
drywall.
Yeah, then have your drywall hung on channel. You'll lose a half an inch of headroom, but any good drywall contractor is going to know how to install the channel. So the only thing that transfers then is you've got screws about every 2 feet that little noise can move through. But that's very different than having those solid joists that will transfer noise from the upstairs to the basement.
Uh-huh. Okay, so do both of them.
Yep. Do both, yes.
Does outside wall insulation qualify for an energy credit?
I don't know. I think you'll have to probably go to Focus on Energy to check that.
Yeah, Focus on Energy has that information, yeah.
Okay, and the other thing is, on a concrete floor, do you need a vapor barrier if you're using tile, ceramic tile, and also carpeting, a combination? I mean, is that, and it seems to be a very dry basement, but I'm just...
No. if you are using ceramic tile, you can simply go right over the concrete. If you're using a wood floor or a plywood floor, then you actually use a semi-permeable vapor barrier to control. You allow some moisture to come through the concrete so the space stays dry.
Okay.
But the ceramic tile is a wonderful idea. It really is the best way to avoid indoor air quality problems with the basement floor.
Oh, mm-hmm. Your suggestions are just terrific. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Len in Madison next. Len, hello.
Hello. I built a cottage up in northern Michigan about 20 years ago. It was an A-frame cottage, and I used a lot of stains on there. And I got some formulas from the Forest Products Laboratory for mixing these stains. Now, I still got those somewhere, and I don't know where they are, but I can dig them out. But you had to put linseed oil in for a redwood stain. You could get a dark redwood stain or a light redwood stain, or if you leave that out, you could get the sort of brown stains. And I'm just wondering, do they still have those formulas? And after I got tired of mixing those stains, I went to Hallman Paints. And on their cans of like redwood stains, they had it marked from the formulas of the Forest Products Laboratory. And I bought quite a few of those stains because I got tired of mixing them. And I'm just wondering if they have those formulas.
Okay.
Well, certainly there are many commercial products that evolved out of the original Forest Products Lab semi-transparent stain. And the website and the link that I just talked about earlier will get you to some information there. One of the components in that early formulation was a mildewcide, which is not widely available to the public or not available to the public to purchase. And so that's a kind of a key component that's missing. So I don't think our finishing chemists would advocate the home remedy anymore, or the home recipe. And there are certainly commercial products that will outperform that original formula.
Okay. But you could go to the Forest Products Lab website. If you typed in Forest Products Laboratory /Madison, it would come up. I'm pretty sure of that.
Or www.fpl.fs.fed.us, and go to the paints and finishes link there. And there's lots of finishing, what we call tech lines, that have a variety of answers for different finishing questions.
All right. Thanks, Lam. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. Charles in Fifield, you are next. Hi, Charles.
Oh, how are you today?
Good.
Yes, I have a floor. It's red oak, and we got it down in Florida at my son's house. He had it cut and dried 2 years ago after the last hurricane.
Uh-huh.
And then we drug up all the way up here to northern Wisconsin, and we put it down, and we did, you know, the paper and everything, and come back. We have it heated in the winter because we're not here. And the floor has got a lot of little, it almost came apart because the wood curled sideways, you know, just.
Yeah.
What's the easiest, what would you recommend putting in some of these holes? Some are as much as 3/16, like a vinyl caulk or something. Just to keep the dirt out, you know, because I think it's done moving now.
Well, it was probably not dried properly to begin with.
I think so, yeah. He said 3%.
Well, unless it was kiln dried, and kiln drying is typically down to 6 or 8%.
He had a kiln dry, I guess.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's what I think. But maybe he had it cut wrong or something. I don't know. It's really nice looking, but.
Well, yeah. Certainly if it's face grain, which a lot of oak is, that will shrink a little more than if it's what we call vertical grain cut. But that sounds like a lot of shrinkage to me for material that was dry. I'm not sure that, I don't know what John would recommend as far as filling these cracks.
There's not that many of them, but just where there are, you know, it looks.
One of the problems is if the moisture content in the house goes back up and these joints want to close again, if you have them all filled with something, that may create some problems.
Oh, yeah. The vinyl caulk would, you know, compress.
John, what do you think?
Well, caulking is probably, this is probably a pretty floor, and caulk's probably not going to look very good. I can tell you what we do with cracks in old plank flooring, because we use a lot of recycled plank flooring. And we actually cut very small wood wedges. We friction fit them in, and then we plane them off. And so if you've got some of the same oak, you may want to cut little little Vs and basically just push them in, plane them down, and refinish them. If the floor really expands, they're going to pop right out. So rather than have the floor curl, but that is the traditional way of taking care of plank flooring. I know you don't have planks; you've got narrow pieces of wood.
Yes.
But inserting these, you know, basically inserting these long little strips of wood right in there, and on the old plank floors, I think it really looks pretty interesting. Whenever I get to Europe, I go into houses and look at the old floors and. I see all these wedges that have been put in over the centuries. Every time a crack opened up, they put another wedge in.
Everybody's looking at the stuff, and you're looking at the floor. Right?
Yeah, well, no, I'm an odd guy.
Yeah.
Thanks, Charles.
Why, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. John from Milwaukee would like you guys to talk about sustainable options for choosing wood. We've been talking about wood a lot today. He thinks that using woods like the Brazilian cherry, for example, is not good to use for a lack of sustaining wood forests. I don't know. What do you think, Bob?
Well, in mentioning Brazilian cherry, I wasn't necessarily advocating it, only to say that it's a popular wood out there. There are some certification programs in the U.S. that can give you advisement as far as the sustainability of certain wood products. There are a lot of wood products that come into this country, especially some of the exotic woods that all of us love to see in homes that, quite frankly, aren't sustainably harvested. So I think these programs are important, and they're good programs to follow because they do give you some assurance that the wood that's coming out is managed in a sustainable fashion.
Mm. And what were the – do you have a name for one of those –
I know the American Forest and Paper Association has one certification program, and there's another one, a popular program out there that I whose name escapes me. But I think if you search on the internet on sustainable forest products, that'll get you to the couple of programs that are nationally recognized.
Perry in Three Lakes, Wisconsin. Hi to you.
Good afternoon, Larry and guests.
Good afternoon.
I have a question on moss buildup on shingle roof.
Okay.
Particularly where the roof is shaded by a tree. I've been installing the zinc strip on the top of the peak, but that doesn't seem to kill the moss any too quickly.
Did you take the moss off that was there before you put the zinc strips on?
I tried to remove as much as I could, but it almost seems like as you remove the moss, you remove the aggregate along with it in spots. And I'm wondering if there's anything like, I've tried bleach, and that doesn't seem to help too much. But I was wondering, how about Roundup? Would that be something to use?
No, Roundup wouldn't work.
I don't think moss is broadleaf.
Okay.
John, what do you what?
Asphalt's a tough one. You know, I know zinc and copper work on wood roofs, but I think some of that is in combination with some of the naturally occurring acids that are within the within the cedar, the redwood itself. The asphalt roofs, it seems that the way to keep the moss off is to try to keep the airflow and the sunshine on it, which is probably more tree trimming and making sure the brush is clear and those sorts of things. If you're up in Three Lakes in the North Woods, that may be rather difficult. I don't know if the zinc strips will perform on an asphalt roof to the extent that they do with that they do on a wood roof.
Oh. Yeah,
it does work to a certain extent. You can see that if you look at an old roof below the chimney line, you'll often below the chimney where there's a zinc or copper flashing around the chimney, you'll see that part of the roof is cleaner than the rest of the roof. So it has some action, but I think getting rid of large amounts of moss is more than you can expect from those strips.
Well, it depends on how wide's the strip you're using, Perry.
I'd say about 2 inches.
Oh, okay. You can get 10 and 14-inch strips from Clower Industries. And I think Clower's got a website, and I think 2 inches, you're just not generating the amount of zinc that you need. But maybe check with Clower. I think they ship them in 10-foot sections, and so you can put a really pretty significant zinc cap up there. See if that works, and then call us back in a year and let us know whether we gave you good advice or not.
But get off as much as you can before you do anything else. That's the important thing. John and Bob, thank you so much. Time flew by.
Great being here, Larry.
Thanks a lot. John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates in Fitchburg and Bob Falk of the U.S. Forest Products Lab in Madison, our guest today. Always fun to have him along, and I'm sure we'll be talking more home renovation in the weeks and months to come. Tomorrow, just to let you know, that's another edition of Garden Talk coming up, and Bob Tomisch is our guest. He's a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.